A history of comedy. It's seven old jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
A history of comedy. It's seven old jacks. A history of comedy.
Come and have a rummage in the archive.
Hello and welcome to A History of Comedy in Several Objects, a podcast brought to you by the University of Kent based on the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive. The Stand-Up Comedy Archive exists to collect, preserve and make accessible material relating to stand-up comedy. In this podcast, we take one record per episode, discuss the object and see what it can tell us about the history and form of stand-up comedy.
I'm Ollie Double, this is Elspeth Miller, and we are very much the ginger and black of comedy archiving.
Oh. I know the name, I just can't
remember. Well, ginger and black is an act from, a sort of recent act, is a double act, male-female double act, which is comparatively rare, I think. She is ginger, he is black, hence the name. Ginger and Black, and that's one of their first jokes. I don't really know much about them except that they were on Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle, and I thought they were really funny. And
also, they're very new.
Recent. I mean, I'm not sure they're still going as a double act. You know, when you Google them, you find it sort of tends to run out three or four years ago, maybe. They are, though. I Googled before we started this, Eri Jackson and Daniel Taylor. And if they are still going, go and see them, because I bet they're great, even though I've never seen them live.
Cool.
Okay, but anyway, that said, what is the comedy item from the archive today?
So we are looking at a folder of material from the Ivor Dembina collection. And the folder of material is mainly brochures, from the Pranksters Comedy kind of agency, are we calling them?
I don't know what we'd call them. Okay. I've been thinking about this because Pranksters was an organisation that started life as a pranking agency. Like, the idea was, you know, you could set your mate up for a practical joke. And then it became a sort of an organisation that promoted... I suppose it was a promotion company, in a way.
Because Ivor does say... they weren't agents and they didn't want to be agents.
That's right. They didn't want to be agents. But, you know, basically the we'll talk a bit more about it later in the episode, but in the sort of nascent alternative cabaret / alternative comedy scene, it was very much a sort of cottage industry and nobody quite knew how it worked. And so there was a series of venues, there was a series of performers who all formed part of this scene in a way. But nobody was doing much to systematically promote it. So what Pranksters was an organisation that represented comedians in the sense that it could send out packages of comedy to venues or organisations to do shows for them. And it also ran venues as well. So, in fact, I read quite recently Julian Clary's autobiography. I think it's called A Young Man's Passage, which is very, very good. It's excellent. It's a really, really, really great read and quite touching. But in that, he reproduces his diary from, I think, 1985, and he has entries for each gig that he wrote about how the gig had gone. It's fascinating. And one of them is Pranksters at something like Southampton University. I can't remember. It's a university gig for sure. And that was obviously a Pranksters gig run by Ivor Dembina.
So is that when Julian Clary was performing as the Joan Collins fan club?
I think he would have been performing as the Joan Collins fan club at that point. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah. Cool. So what have you got in the folder?
So the folder is mainly three brochures for Pranksters, the alternative comedy promoters. Let's call them
that.
As well as a few kind of, there's another kind of an A4 sheet as well, advertising a set of performers, which we call
Let's
the
look
package.
At that first, maybe.
Okay, yeah, so this is just an A4 sheet, which I guess was meant to be folded into an A5 flyer. And it's advertising, the package, which were promoted by Pranksters, and you'd book them through Pranksters. But the package was made up of David Cohen, Cecilia Scanlon, and Ivor Dembina.
With?
Steve Edgar.
So let's just talk about them, because none of those, I mean, Ivor's still working today, and Dave Cohen is as well. Dave Cohen is a sort of comedy script writer, and his name will turn up on things like the chairman's script for the news quiz, I think, still. Certainly did that for a long time. He also occasionally turns up on things like Chortle, writing about, you know, an article about some aspect of alternative comedy past. His articles are very good, actually. They're very interesting. I did a gig when I was first started doing open spots in London in 1989 with Dave Cohen. The only joke I remember of his was actually quite good, and he was talking about the old 1960s Batman series, and he said, what's the criminal justice system like in Gotham? You know, because Batman, has these criminals put in prison, the Joker or the Penguin or whatever, and the next episode they're back out. How does that work? Obviously his version of that was much funnier, but that was the premise. Cecilia Scanlon, I don't know, and that's fascinating, because people always say about alternative comedy it was supposed to be non-sexist. Do you want to read the thing?
Okay, so underneath Cecilia Scanlon it says, middle-aged, raunchy Cecilia Scanlon is the token woman in the act. Which is quite interesting.
I don't know where the state's from, really.
It's interesting they'd use that language to describe.
I mean, my guess is there weren't that many female comics around, and so what they're doing is turning... Well, for a start, they've got a woman on the bill, which is good. Secondly, my guess is they've used the token woman thing as a kind of slightly like jokey, tongue-in-cheek, ironic thing to sort of say, you know, it's a shame we've only got one sort of thing.
Which is what Linda Smith was in a double act, Token Women.
She was.
But then they changed it to Tough Lovers.
Tough Lovers. That's right, yeah.
Because I don't know. I think they thought it was too not funny.
And then you've got Ivor.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Ivor looking ridiculously young in that photo, it has to be said. Also, I'm disturbed to see Cecilia Scanlon described as middle-aged, because she looks at least 10 years younger than I am now. And I know I'm middle-aged, right? But I'd say maybe 15 years younger than I am now. And then Steve Edgar. I mean, I did an open spot in a venue called Spots in Nottingham, Spots with a Z rather than S at the end, in Nottingham in 1986, late 1986, and I was absolutely chronic. I was terrible. And I'll tell you who else was on the bill was Hattie Hayridge, and then a comedy theatre company was the other act. And Steve Edgar was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant. He did a routine which I think seems quite ahead of its time. It was mainly sort of observation. I remember him doing a brilliant thing about things that you see all the time, and he talked about being on the top deck of a bus and seeing a single shoe on top of a bus shelter, and I think that is a really, really good observation. But I remember he did a thing where he was wearing two watches. This was one of his routines. He said, I'm wearing two watches, can anybody guess why? And people shouted out jokes. And I remember one of the jokes somebody shouted out was, you're in a neighbourhood watch scheme, which is very topical because that was quite a new thing at that time. And then he said, and then at the end of it, he goes, no, the reason I'm wearing two watches is so I could do an impression of an alien. Now, unfortunately, this is a visual joke, so I can't... You're going to have to try and visualise how I describe it. What he did was he held his wrists up so that the watch faces were in front of his eyes, right? So they look like alien eyes. And then he wiggled his fingers as if it was like weird tentacly alien hair. And that was the punchline. And I remember that, like, 32 years on. So it obviously made an impression. I remember him being brilliant. And the thing that really struck me about him was that he was really, really... Him and one of the guys in the theatre group and nobody else on the bill just seemed to feel, like, really at home on stage. And I just went, there's something going on here. It's not just the material. There's something about how they are, the state of mind they're on the state of mind they're in on stage as makes them funnier. So yeah, Steve, and you know, you just don't ever hear of Steve Edgar now. I don't know what happened to him, but he was, I think, a really funny comedian. And that kind of routine that he did with the watchers, it's the sort of thing that Sarah Millican does really well now. You know, in other words, she'll put our question out, the audience will pitch in, she'll respond to them, then she'll come in with things that the other audiences have said in response to the same question, and at the end she'll do her bit, so it finishes it off, and it's a really nice interactive way to do a bit. But the first time I ever saw somebody doing it, it was Steve Edgar.
I'm going to ask a question which is going slightly off track.
Go for it.
Away from pranksters for the minute. But so you said he seemed like he was really at home on stage.
Yeah.
And that kind of made him funny. Is that not for all performers, do you think, like all comedians? Do you think that's universal across comedians, is that once you're on stage you feel at home? And
I think it's something you need to get. I think you need to get to the point where you, even if you're absolutely crapping it inside, you need to sort of give the impression that you are absolutely, utterly at home on stage. I mean, I think even somebody who plays on being nervous shows an underlying control, which the audience recognises. I suppose what I was seeing was, I think Hattie Heyridge was quite new at that point. So I don't, I think that's why she didn't show that. Also, her style was very different anyway. It was sort of deadpan and, you know, she did the kind of thing that she's famous for now, really, which is very clever jokes, slightly surreal, you know, done in a deadpan style and her playing a slightly offbeat character. So it's a slightly different thing. But, I mean, she was very inexperienced, I think. I was absolutely hopeless. Mm. You know, I definitely didn't have it. But like I say, this guy in the comedy theatre company, there was one, I think there were about three or four members of that company, and there was one guy in it who just sort of shone. It was like light coming off him. It's just, I think you know, great actors have it as well. I saw David Tennant on stage, I think it was last year, and he definitely had that. But I think with comedians, it's a really important quality. You know, yeah. Okay, so there are three catalogues of pranksters.
Yes. Do you want to describe them?
Well, let's just I know that we've got a clip of Ivor looking through and sort of commenting on the acts from the first one. I thought we could just introduce them as items and then we could hear some clips of Ivor talking about them.
Okay, so we think the earliest one is... Well, we don't know the date, do we?
We don't know the dates of any of them.
The first one is kind of a homemade kind of brochure, really, isn't
it's
it?
It's definitely got a homemade-y vibe about it. It's
held together with one of these kind of, I don't know what you'd call them, like those clips that kind of hold together papers.
Yeah, it's like a metal thing with arms that fold under kind of almost like belt loops. Mm. And it goes through, you have to have two punctures in to fit it together. And it's got two... kind of, I don't know what colour you call this, but like almost like an orangey
peach.
Yeah, kind of peach coloured card things. Then inside you've got pages which have either been photocopied on a not that great photocopier, so you've got fade and stuff, or it's possible that they were offset litho printed to not that great a standard. And it's it's not professionally typeset, I don't think. It looks like it's been done on perhaps an electric typewriter. The font, it's not like a proper font, it's like a typewritten type font. And that's the first one, I think.
Yeah, so the first one doesn't have any details of sort of how it was printed.
No.
Does it? But it still looks like a lot of work went into it. I don't know anything about printing kind of in the 80s, but yeah. They've all the performers, there's a page per performer,
yeah,
or group, and they've all sort of got the pranksters kind of board around them, haven't they?
With a logo and a phone number.
Yeah. Oh, apart from this one. Oh no, that's down on the side there.
Oh, there we go.
So it's been sort of semi-professionally produced, hasn't it?
It's definitely an efficient document.
And this first one has the sort of introduction from Ivor and Jonathan Richards.
Who was his business partner, kind of thing.
So that's sort of setting the scene for what Pranksters was.
Yeah. And then the other ones that we've got are clearly... I think you could... I mean, we don't know for sure, but I think that we can work out a running order for these. So that's definitely the first one, because it's the most sort of, like, homemade-y looking one. This one, we think, is the second one. And do you want to describe what that one's like?
It's got more of a card front and backing, hasn't it? It's glossy. It's a glossy front.
And that looks like it's been professionally printed.
Yeah, well, on the back it does say, design, typesetting and origination by Lasso Cooperative, who are based on the St Pancras Way.
Yeah.
And the printing was by Trojan Printing Cooperative. in sort of East London. So we were talking earlier, that's quite interesting that they were both kind of cooperatives. And what did that mean at the time?
Absolutely. Well, a cooperative is a slightly more right-on-y thing, isn't it? It's a kind of... It's a non sort of thrusting capitalism way of doing things. It's a more kind of lefty business in a way, isn't it? A cooperative. I remember in the 80s when I was doing my drama degree in the early 80s, quite a lot of the small touring theatre, they were still called alternative theatre companies that came to the little studios where we used to go watch theatre, were called theatre cooperatives. It was quite a thing. I think that is significant, probably.
It's a similar sort of setup then, isn't it? It's, again, a page per performer or group of performers. So each page has sort of a picture, the name of the performer, and a kind of a blurb about them.
I mean, I'm going to go back and say I think that first one is definitely photocopied and not offset litho, because I think that's offset litho printed. Okay. And it's, you can see the print quality is much sharper, and it's also been properly typeset. Mm. Also, there's a photo there of Ivor in a sort of charity shop type jumper on the phone, pretending to be on the phone with his partner Jonathan Richards. The little thing saying Jonathan Richards and Ivor Dembina, which is quite nice. And
then the third one is similarly.
And both
it's not as glossy, actually, is it?
No, but similarly, it's a proper kind of card cover.
Yeah.
Oh, and also the cover is two-colour printing, which in offset litho means it has to go through the printer twice. So it's a more expensive form of printing. Okay. But also both of them are bound with these sort of plastic spines that you can sort of clip things in, you know. So you know, you could take it apart and put it back together again if you needed to do that.
This third one is minus an introduction this time from Ivor
and Jonathan. I think that means that they think that the alternative cabaret is well enough established for them to not have to explain what it is.
And pranksters, I presume, as well.
Probably, yeah.
So this is marked as new extended edition on the cover. But similarly, follows a similar sort of format and structure to previous...
That one's leaping off the page at me there.
Podomowski?
Okay. It was Dusty and Dick.
Ah, okay.
Dusty and Dick. Now, one of those should be familiar to you, one of those performers.
Oh, that looks like...
You know it.
I do know it. I do. I just can't... give me a clue.
Yeah, it works with Paul Whitehouse.
Yeah, no. I know. I just can't think of his name.
Name begins with H. Harry Enfield. It's Harry Enfield.
Yeah.
Harry Enfield looking ridiculously young there.
So is he Dusty or Dick?
Oh, that's a really good question. I have no idea. I don't know. That's a really good question. If somebody knows who's listening to this podcast, then please do, you know, contact us and let us know which one was Dusty, which one was Dick, which one was Harry. Harry Enfield. I say Harry like I know him. I've never met him in my life. And underneath, we've got Steve Edgar there. And what does it say here? It describes him as a survivor.
Yes, with a head this time.
Yeah, with a head.
On the leaflet we were looking at earlier, it's sort of, I can't quite tell. What has he got?
I don't know. It looks
a bag
like
on his head, or is it with a lampshade?
I don't know.
Or is he minus a head, and it's kind of smoke coming out of his neck?
Yeah, exactly. It kind of looks like there's trails of smoke or sort of blast lines coming out from where his head should be in the cartoon and the other thing, in the Harder package flyer. But in this thing, we actually see a photo of him with a big old smile. Strong features, that's how I'd describe his face.
And I presume he's a comedian, because it wasn't really super clear on this one. No.
He was pretty much a straightforward stand-up. And like I say, from what I remember, he was really good. Mm. I mean, that's the thing. I think there's a feeling that because comedy is much more ruthless and competitive and professional now, that it's sort of better now, that the technical standard is higher. And I think there are elements of that that are kind of true, in as much as I know there are accounts of people who were working in the mid-80s who say things like, we saw American comedians, and they took the mic out of the stand and we thought... It's amazing you could do that. So there was a thing of it being very new and people discovering things. But on the other hand, some of the stuff that people were doing was brilliant. And I reckon that it would absolutely give a run for the money of people working today. And I would hold, certainly in my memory from 32 years ago, I'd hold Steve Edgar up as an example of that. Mm. So okay, well look, that's the documents. Let's have a clip now of Ivor talking a bit about Pranksters and why it was sort of set up.
Edit.
I was mindful of the complaint that from the acts that only had one gig a week, and I thought, fuck it, we'll open a club, we'll give them a and we did. And on the it was in a, you know, we gradually, I made, and that's where the, but we thought, what we'll do is and out of that we decided to have a brochure of acts put together. We'd do two things. One, we'd run our own little gig, and two, we'd try and sell little packages of entertainment of the kind that, the idea had come from a customer, not us. And sell packages of the entertainment to whomever wanted it. And, you know, we were just floundering around. We didn't do marketing or market research. We just, well, this is interesting. This is great. We were getting to know the acts through our own club, which was initially in Tufton Park. It was called Pranksters. We took the same name as the practical jokes agency, Pranksters, and put on gigs. And on the first gig I ever did, it was in the foyer of a church in Tufton Park. It was something like John Eagley, Clive Anderson, Ben Elton, and someone like that, you know, again, Matt McDonald. And the audience just loved it. I mean, you know. And it was just extraordinary. And as I had that idea, I'm not saying I was the first, almost at the same time, there were people having the same idea as me.
Edit!
So the first thing to say is that I did the interview with Ivor in his flat, and it was a strange one for me to do in one way, in that the very first person I ever interviewed for my research was Ivor back in 1988. He'd been doing a gig with Linda Smith, actually, as part of, I think, the Sheffield Festival at the Sheffield Crucible studio. And he kindly let me interview him. And it was fascinating, actually, talking to him. And so it was really interesting to sort of do an interview all these years on with him. And I spoke to him for well over an hour. And he had lots of interesting things to say. And I remember at the time thinking, I better mention the fact that he was drinking from a small plastic water bottle, because you can hear that clicking throughout the clips we've got in this episode. But you know, that if you don't get too distracted by that, it's just Ivor needing to hydrate. But it's worth mentioning as well that Pranksters started life not anything to do with alternative comedy, but as a practical jokes agency, sort of briefly mentions there. So the idea was that ring up and say, I want a prank played on my friend, and they would do that. And I think the BBC made a documentary about them, which Paul Merton was in. I think we might even have it in there, in the folder. I think there was an article in a magazine where Paul Merton talks about it. This is from, I don't know, does it say what magazine it's from?
It's an IPC magazine.
There we go.
From 1993.
Oh, hold on, it says on the back, Family Circle.
Oh, is that the magazine name?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Don't.
My mum used to read Family Circle when I was a child. That's the only reason I know.
Okay. So do you want me to read?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Is the bit about Pranksters
there
obvious?
Is. So, yes. He says, Ivor ran a company called Pranksters, which specialised in providing practical jokes to order. This is actually the only thing in Ivor's collection relating to that, like, company.
Right.
Which is interesting. But, for example, if you required a policeman with no trousers on to wander around your girlfriend's back garden, then you phoned Pranksters and they made it happen. Ivor asked me if I was interested in this kind of work. I made it very clear that I wasn't. Then he goes on, 8 months later, he phoned me, Dembina here, BBC Two are filming a documentary about Pranksters. Do you want to walk around somebody's back garden dressed as a policeman with no trousers on for £300? And he answered yes. So yeah, I think that's all about pranksters, really.
So that's what it was, and then he, through this, he became involved in the circuit initially, this sort of promotion company also called Pranksters. I mean, it was sort of like one business elided into the next, and then later as a sort of compere and performer. And I suppose, yeah, it goes back to what I was saying before. I mean, this stage, you know, I mean, alternative comedy is often deemed to have started when the Comedy Store opened on the 19th of May, 1979. So I'm not completely, we don't have a date precisely on this, but my guess is that the first brochure is probably from about 83, 84 maybe. So if it's, let's say it's 84, then, you know, you're talking about alternative comedy is only about 5 years old. And at that point, you know, the early stars have mainly moved on, you know. So Alexis Sale didn't ever really play the circuit. He played the Comedy Store and the Comic Strip and one or two other venues like the Albany Empire. And he did gigs with Alternative Cabaret. And then he was off. I mean, by 82, he was touring as a comedian, as a named comedian. Rick Mayall and Ed Edmondson had done, by 84, had done probably two series of The Young Ones, because the first one was 82 and the second was 84. French and Saunders had guested on that and, you know, started doing bits and bobs. I think they had a sort of pilot as part of a series called The Entertainers in something like 83, 84. Their own series was round the corner. So a lot of those sort of early people had sort of moved on to not better things, but bigger things, you know, quite early. And then what had been left behind was a group of performers who, some of whom were going to go do that shortly afterwards, like Ben Elton was headed for the Stratosphere around this time. Interesting that Ivor mentioned him in relation to the first Pranksters gig. But you had, you know, people like Jeremy Hardy started at the beginning of 84, for example. So it's a really interesting time. The scene is actually growing and the number of venues is expanded and venues come and venues go. And I think what it needed at this stage was an organisation like Pranksters to sort of promote it a bit. And actually around the same time, he mentioned other people starting, Off the Curb started.
Yeah, so I was wondering about that, because they were very much an agency, weren't they?
Where
they
did represent.
So were there other organisations like other promoters, like Pranksters?
Yeah, I mean, really, in a way, the first to systematically pick up on this was probably Phil McIntyre, who promoted, I think, you know, well, Alexis Sale's tour, I think, promoted Ben Elton's tours with Rick Mayall and then subsequently solo. I think he maybe did the Comic Strip as well, I'm not sure. So that was an early thing. And other established promoters came in to promote this stuff. I think Phil McIntyre mainly done music before that point. But Off the Curb was the first really big breakaway agency and Addison Cresswell had been an ENTS officer in Brighton, you know, at college or whatever. And I think he first started doing things with, I don't know, Roy Hutchins and people like that. And another great stand-up, by the way, who people don't remember at all today, but fantastic. I saw his show, I forget the exact title, but it's called something like Space Hoppers, Clackers, A Really Big Fish. I saw that in the late 80s, and it was absolutely brilliant. I still remember bits of it today. But yeah, so he did things like that. And I know that Addison Cresswell also worked on the Red Wedge comedy tour.
Okay.
And in fact, he first met Joe Norris, who I think runs Off the Curb today, who's a very interesting guy. He first sort of met Addison Cresswell and got involved with Off the Curb via involvement with the Red Wedge comedy tour. So yeah, it was ripe for somebody to kind of, in a way, I don't know about professionalise, but promote it to make it more widely known and successful kind of thing.
So were Pranksters a bit more like Alternative Cabaret than they were as a kind of a collective of performers who would sort of send themselves out in sort of groups of three or four, as opposed to more of an agency like Off the Curb?
I suppose so, but the difference, I think, is that Alternative Cabaret, being with capital A, capital C, the thing that Tony Allen set up, was a collective, and although people came and people went, it certainly boiled down to becoming more like a core of actual members who would each promote, you know, or each had the responsibility to kind of get work for the group sort of thing. Whereas I think with this, Ivor and Jonathan Richards were kind of in charge of it, and they would get presumably the agreement of the people they represented to tout their wares kind of thing. Okay. So I think it's slightly, probably somewhere between the two. Mm. But I mean, I think even Off the Curb, which probably quite quickly within a few years got a reputation for being slightly business ruthless and business orientated, that was still a really small organisation. I think actually at this point it might be worth listening to the second clip of the interview with Ivor.
Edit.
We were the first people, we were among, because again, other people had the same idea. We were the first people to commodify it, basically, is what I think the word you're looking for. We didn't know what we were doing. We knew we didn't want to be agents. We didn't want to be responsible for these people. But we really saw, I mean, we weren't doing it to get rich. You know, it was not like we set up a business to get rich. We were doing it. We didn't really know what we were doing, but we thought, this is great. We reckon there's a demand for this, and we're going to have a go at selling it. It was we didn't have an office. I think we did it out of my front room, you know, with a phone and, I don't even know if it was a computer, a phone and a typewriter in those days. Yeah, we typed the invoices, didn't you have computers? And it was all just, and of course the acts liked it because we were quite well organised comparatively. The gigs themselves had a fairly kind of loose and very enjoyably loose feel. But we just, I think the difference what we brought to it was we were going to take this, what was essentially London-centric thing, and offer it out elsewhere to whoever wants it, like colleges, art centres, anyone. If anyone said, hey, I hear you do comedy shows. And we said, yeah. Well, can you send us one? How much would it cost? Well, you know, you could have a short show for £100, a longer show for £200 and all the rest of it. We were selling it like meat, but underneath it, we really did believe in the product as well.
Edit.
See, what I find really interesting about that is he uses the word commodification and he talks about selling comedy like meat. And in a way, you could say, well, this is just pure Thatcherism. You know, instead of theatre companies being funded by Arts Council grants or whatever, you've got a purely market-driven approach. But you have to remember that the vast majority of people on the circuit were lefties. And we've already mentioned the fact that these brochures are printed by cooperatives. And I think that if it was commodified, which it clearly was, I mean, anything that's sold is, I mean, you're turning it into a commodity. It was also something that was kind of organic and done for the love of it as much as for the money of it. I mean, when he says he believed in the product, I mean, any capitalist will tell you that, I would have thought. But at the same time, I think it's more than just believing in the product. I think it's like, I'm really excited about this scene and I want it to be more than just London-centric, as he says. Because, it did spread beyond London quite quickly in some ways, in the sense of Alexis Sale toured the UK in 82, for example. And things like Brighton had alternative comedy events in, I don't know, 80 or something. But really, it was even when I got involved in the sort of mid to late 80s, it was mainly a London thing. So I think the idea of Pranksters taking things beyond the boundaries of the London A to Z was probably significant, you know. And I, again, the other thing is when he talks about it being done out of his bedroom or whatever, you know, with just a phone and what have you, Off the Curb would have been the same. You know, that Addison Cresswell, who, you know, such a reputation as being this sort of formidable businessman. You know, he was a guy who found this stuff exciting, you know, was involved with the lefty side of it, being involved in the Red Wedge tour and, you know, was running this agency out of his bedroom, you know, that kind of thing. So I find that cottage industry aspect of it really interesting.
Did they put forward performers for a bill or would it be a purely prankster show?
That's a great question.
And if they were just sort of putting forward acts to a sort of a mixed bill, would they then be kind of badged as pranksters' acts? Or?
I am almost certain, I am 90% certain, that it would have been that it was just the shows they promoted. So it would have been their venue, the pranksters' venue, and it would have been them sending out a package of acts. Like it said, harder package. It's that. It's like, well, pranksters are So when Julian Clary, for example, did that gig in Southampton University or wherever it was, that's a Pranksters night, okay. And it's called Pranksters, and it's badged as Pranksters. I think that's what they did. I don't think that, because otherwise it really would have been much more of an agency. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they would have had an exclusive deal with any of the acts in their brochure, to be honest, because, you know, I'm sure some of these were probably doing gigs for Off the Curb and things like that as well. Mm-hmm. Sure they would have been. So the last thing I asked Ivor about was, I thought we'd sit down with him and see what he remembered about the acts in the first edition of the Pranksters brochure. So what we have now is a clip with him just going through the acts. Should we have a listen to that?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Edit.
So perhaps we'll look through, I don't know, maybe the first edition.
Yeah, good.
Because one of the things I think is interesting about looking through them is the variety of acts. This is not just comedians. So,
well, perhaps I should have added to when we talked about the quality of the entertainment. Like now, cheapness became everything. The cheapness. I can't let your listeners know how economics played a part. In the early days, one of the wonderful things about the circuit was its eclectic nature. You had weird kind of acts, you know. Just did, you know, very visual mime, props, experimental, all that was, it was just very free. But as television, because once you put on a visual act, then, you know, the cameras have to be rehearsed, where are we going to see the trick and where are we going to see the stunt? Television won't bother that, they just want to see some bloke where they're standing still. Camera on his face, tell us your jokes, mate. It was all led by keeping the costs down and find the most visually interesting stand-ups. I mentioned Ben Elton. She's a great stand-up, but Jo Brand was a gift because she's got a very... memorable face. Let's put it that way. And, you know, look great on canvas. Put a bit of lipstick on her, pull her hair out, and she just, you'd never forget her. You know.
She's also quite a still performer. She doesn't move.
Very still. Very still. Whereas other acts who were just as funny, who I'm a great admirer of this, so I hope you won't mind, but someone like Jeremy Hardy, fantastic comedian, in my opinion, one of my all-time favourites. Just looked very pallid and uninteresting. The camera just didn't like him. It just didn't like him. So it became a search for the comedians who the camera liked or who could create something which in somehow took their stand-up personality and was very easy to enhance. Harry Enfield, loads of money. Who could, you know, out a bit later on, Al Murray, which is, you know, just standing there with a beer glass in his hand. Julian Clary, you know, dressing up as a woman with lots of makeup, a small dog there. I mean, it sounds like I'm contradicting myself. I hope I'm not. The point is, acts that were easy to film, you know. And I'm not. Don't get me wrong. These people. I don't want these people to come and get me. I'm not trying to imply.
No, but what you're saying is that certain acts who were great on the circuit didn't translate as easily.
No, not at all.
But also, the variety of acts is amazing. So Tony was one of the first. You mentioned already one of the first.
First one I ever saw.
Chris Barry was an impressionist who went on to be in Red Dwarf.
Yep.
And, you know, very big star at one point.
Yeah.
These guys, so I don't know anything about.
I'm not sure I do.
Christians from Outer Space, Mime and Sketchers.
Don't remember. Bear in mind, I'm looking at this for 30 years later myself. Yeah.
Andrew Bailey, who you mentioned, who did various different kind of weird comedy acts.
Definitely, yeah.
And then Bernard Padden, who is a kind of northern gay guy, quite gentle.
Yeah, quite gentle. Kind of ahead of his time, I thought. I don't know what became of Bernard Padden, but yeah.
The Oblivion Boys, a very sort of high-energy kind of double act, who did lager commercials.
Yeah, they got famous for... They used to do this lovely bit. They were the first... They were great, don't they? Steve Frost. I don't know what happened to these people, a lot of them, but they did this brilliant bit where they did this double act. You know, they were doing classic, you know, double act, straight man, funny man, knockabout stuff. And in the middle, one of the, a third comedian, there were two of them, a friend of theirs, who was also a comedian called Lee Corns, who was in Grange Hill in the end, I think. Very good, funny guy. We just come on in the middle of the show or in one scene and say, how much did you earn from those large commercials? One of them just said, £157,000, £80 of that. What? Can you say that? Yeah, £157,000. I'm obviously improvising the amount, but they just told the world the ridiculous amount of money that they were making because they found it funny in itself. Yeah, it's great. You wouldn't get that now. They were happy to make fun of themselves. Yeah.
And also, in a way, that joke is interesting, isn't it? Because it speaks to how this amateurishness that you talked about, this joyful amateurishness, was massive contradiction to the fact that suddenly somebody picks them up and commodifies them by putting them on telly to sell lager, and the amount of money is just massively disproportionate to what you'd expect to get for doing a gig.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is more like, my guess is, this is more like the street theatre wing.
Yeah, a lot of people came to us who, from the street, you know, buskers, the Covent Garden was being set up, there was a lot of street performers in Brighton and places like that. Of course, from time to time they get really fed up performing on the street, quite understandably. And a number of them made a serious attempt to adapt what they did on the street to an indoor act.
So this guy, just in case, eccentric mime and unicyclist.
Something like that, yeah, and others. Lee Corns. Mentioned. The WOW show, that's what it was. It was him and the Oblivion Boys. And in that, there was that sketch about what they were making about. Yeah,
and then Terry McDonald, comic and music man featuring the singing jukebox. Mm. That was a Covent Garden act, I think, originally. Yeah. Don't know anything about Mr. Chipshop.
I don't remember much about Mr. Chipshop.
But what a great name, though. Mr. Chipshop, you can't argue with it. Jenny LeCote.
Right, we did have a rule, me and my partner, Jonathan, because he eventually quit, he went off to live in Brighton, so I did it on my own. The general rule was, the better the name, the worse the act. What was the name of your Oliver Dunbar? We thought, fuck it, Oliver.
That's my actual name, Oliver. That's the
oh, no!
It is, yeah.
I think you've been...
Do you know what? Dave Gorman never believed me that it was my actual name.
In that case, it's a great
I think I showed him my bank card once and he went... He still didn't believe me. Jenny LeCote, who was a sort of... sort of feminist comedian.
Yes.
She'd start off in the folk clubs.
Yeah. What was interesting was, there's a lot of interesting things about it, but was that people, there was no kind of, it's not like the civil service where there's a route to the top. People came from all different places, some from the folk clubs, many from the street, many, you know, actors who couldn't get work. That's, you know, the successful ones, I'd say, initially, or the big ones, were Elton, Sale and Rick Mayall, all of whom, I think, had acting or writing aspirations that weren't fulfilled, and they found a home. But in addition to that, like Jenny LeCote from the folk scene, Ronnie Golden, a rock and roller, and one was a stripper. I thought we might come to her. I forgot her name. Palm Court Jazz, a little... Yeah, like if you do a... Say, this is what, when we were talking about add-ons. Say, for example, someone was putting on a comedy show I suppose a private setting, and they wanted some early evening entertainment. We'd send them this kind of Palm Court Jazz band. It would just sit and, you know, play Palm Court Jazz while people, you know, drunk, had a drink during the reception.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. So you're thinking about the whole evening.
Well, that's evident.
And presumably this is the same sort of thing. Mary Plum and Robert Hill, clarinet and piano duo.
That's right, yeah, same sort of thing.
Dave Curtis, magician.
Yeah, sort of a Miami magician. I think he quit to become a doctor, actually.
Now, this Lynn Thomas, you mentioned the Brighton Street contingent. Yeah, he was one of them.
He was one of those. He had quite a good indoor act. He was one of those, at the time anyway, adapted his street act to the indoors, and he was quite... He, he did quite a lot of work for us. For him,
John the Juggling Jester, I'd be disappointed if he wasn't a street actor.
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it? I don't remember that.
And then we've got John Heckley.
Well, just a great act, still going. Just a
fantastic.
Fantastic writer, fantastic performer, great bloke, you know, just a real artist.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep.
Ronnie Golden, who you mentioned.
Just on that, just going back to John Heckley.
Yeah.
There's a strain amongst them who, I sensed it a bit with John, who I still see, I regard myself as a friend of. But there was this kind of, there was a tension, which I see in John, and I see in one or two others today, even, of being an entertainer or an artist. You know, they want to be, I don't know, it's not for me to say that that's their aspiration, but there's a sense that, yeah, I sense a definite tension, and I'd include, and this isn't in any way a criticism, it's just an observation, I see that in John Heckley, Simon Munnery, and Daniel Kitson, who is the greatest stand-up comedian I've ever seen. Ronnie Golden, yeah, you know, he brought what he knew. He's a good guitarist and good singer, but he's got a sense of humour, and he just wanted to take, and he was in a quite a well known band at the, I'm told, called the Fabulous Poodles, he's great act. Clive Lanson, just a barrister, brought his sort of barrister's wit and charm, if that's right, to performing. I just saw it brilliant. The most ice cool, got that boat. I remember I see him doing a gig in a rough pub. Well, it was a decent gig, wasn't that? It was a Saturday night gig, you know, we were a bit boozed up. He was up there, you know, sort of being gently, you know, in a very kind of Oxbridge way, but was sort of also self-effacing. And for some reason, someone threw a pair of fucking scissors at the stage and just missed his head. And you without chopping, you without even pausing, but he said, "Do I need a haircut?" Just brilliant. You know, cool, very funny man. Yeah. Very funny. I like him. Nice guy.
There's another band, the Three Mustafas. And Otis Cannelloni, who you mentioned.
He's still going. Very good, very funny.
Randolph Remarkable, another kind of street, kind of crazy street type act.
Yeah, you can't, I can try and describe it, but basically let me just say, it's not self-sufficient. The climax of his act was when he immersed his rather large naked stomach into a bowl of lukewarm water.
You can see him doing it in this picture.
Yeah, in the picture, he's raising it off the floor by... He's got a lovely baby face. great bloke. He was quite friendly with... you might recognise him on TV as, or you would have if it was still going, as a character called Hugh Jelly, who teamed up with
Julian Clary on Sticky Moments.
That's it. Edit.
So, yeah, it's interesting hearing him talking about these different acts. And the fact that he doesn't remember all of them is kind of intriguing. I mean, Christians from Outer Space, for example, if you look at that entry, it's got this photo of a man and a woman in ridiculous costumes pulling ridiculous faces, and their names were Jiminy and Topo, or Topo. Topo, a tiny Guatemalan, and Jiminy, a tall, pliant Scotswoman. Between them paint a darkly amusing canvas of human behaviour on our odd planet, so said Time Out, allegedly. he didn't even remember them. I mean, you'd think they would be memorable, wouldn't you?
Yes.
And I think when he starts, so we talked about Tony Allen, and I just say Tony in the interview. He doesn't even say it's Tony Allen, but obviously Tony Allen, you know, one of the absolutely key pivotal figures in the history of alternative comedy, is the very first act in the first brochure of Pranksters. So if you had to pick one act out of this brochure, Elspeth, which one would you pick out as being your favourite, and why?
I think I'd be intrigued by kind of the street performers generally.
Yeah.
So I think just because of the name, I would go with Randolph. The Remarkable.
Randolph the Remarkable. Fire Eater Extraordinaire. Yeah.
Marvel at his headstands, his back bends, his crabs.
Yeah, that's...
But also, Otis Conlonely on the previous page, I think.
Who's still working today.
Yeah, or well, I could go and see him.
You could maybe, go and see him. And I would recommend that you do. He's very good.
He's dressed as Zorro in this... Well, it's not a picture of him. It's like a drawing, isn't it?
Yeah. I have to say, I've never seen Otis Conlonely perform in anything like that kind of job. He's just a much more normal-looking guy. But I remember his act. I mean, I've seen it within recent years, actually, but I remember it, you know, back in the 80s. It was a really funny act with a rabbit glove puppet and things. Yeah, really stupid jokes, but very, very funny.
What about yourself?
Which one would I like? Well, actually, just before we move on from Randolph the Remarkable, I just wanted to read this out. Gaze at sensational great balls of fire, brackets outdoors only. See feats of skill involving fire and a bowl of lukewarm water. Now, if you buy yourself a copy of, I forget which one it is now, I think it's Saturday Live Series 2, or it might be Series 1, you need to check that. You can find a clip of his act on it. And it's really good. It's really funny. What he does with the bowl of lukewarm water is kind of remarkable in a slightly grotesque and unremarkable way. It's great. I never saw his act live. I'd wish I had. I don't know. I mean, I'm tempted to say Tony Allen because I've seen Tony's act a number of times. He was a brilliant act, and I think I really like Tony. And it's interesting because Tony, who was a pivotal figure on the circuit, is immediately followed by Chris Barry, who was really quite, you know, big name as an impressionist and then as a star of Red Dwarf, who we keep coming across, don't we, Red Dwarf, in this podcast, and the Britas Empire. But I think... and Bernard Padden, I would pick out, because I interviewed him a while ago. He's now a writer and works at university, and he's a super interesting guy. So there are lots that I would like to pick out for various reasons. But I think maybe Andrew Bailey, who's listed as doing different acts here, Harry Benson, Brian Bailey, Podomofsky, and Mr. X. I'm not even sure what he did. So he had these different acts that he could do. And I think that Harry Benson became Frederick Benson, which was a kind of, I don't know, like a sort of weird surrealist mashup of Frankenstein's monster and, I don't know, the voice, maybe a bit Dracula, sort of white face makeup, massive shoulders, this sparkly costume, did really stupid stuff and sort of spoke a bit like this. And Podomofsky was a sort of clowning thing. He also did, I saw him do at the Festival Hall, I saw him do his Lenin act, where he would pretend to be Lenin and then somebody would translate the made up Russian that he would do, and it was very funny. So, yeah, I mean, Andrew Bailey is probably who I'd pick out. But it's very difficult to choose because there are so many, some of whom are widely known now, so Clive Anderson, some of whom are lost in the mists of time, street acts, like you say, or... musical acts like Palm Court Jazz or Mary Plum and Robert Hill, who, if you look at clarinet and piano duo and you look at them and they just look so square, and they play from experience in classical music ranging from solo work to chamber music, orchestral playing, conducting, theatre, opera, etc. And you kind of go, what are they doing in there? It's so odd that they're in amongst those other acts.
Yeah, it does seem kind of at odds with the rest of the acts, I agree. Yeah. But there are a few musical acts, and I think, are all the musical acts kind of serious in that?
I'm not sure, because I think like the Three Mustafas Three, who people have heard people talking about, who were around at the time, I never saw them, but I think they had a few records out. And what I imagine is that they put on a bit of a show. You know, I imagine they were pretty kind of rocking acts that probably had gags and things between the numbers, I think. Is an audience participation and things like that, I reckon. Whereas I think whatever they were called, Mary Plum and whatever they were called, I think that they were probably a bit squarer, is my guess. But who knows? I mean, short of... This is what I always say in this podcast. I really wish I had a TARDIS, because wouldn't it be great to go back and watch some of these acts back in the 80s?
Right.
But this podcast isn't just about us talking to you. It's also about you coming back to us and getting involved in various ways.
Get involved!
There are various ways that you can get involved in this podcast, but first of all, you'll need to know how to contact us. You can email us via standup@kent.ac.uk. That's standup, all one word, no hyphen, @kent.ac.uk. We're also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @histcompod. And we're also on Facebook. We've got a Facebook page.
The first way you can get involved is go to the catalogue, which you can find online, find a listing for a comedy object and nominate it. We'll talk about all nominated objects in future episodes. That's the vanilla version. And if you do that, we're going to send you a badge of the podcast and also a badge of the Stand Up Comedy Archive. So do remember to include a postal address.
The chocolate chip version of getting involved is to send us an email, arrange to come into the Stand Up Comedy Archive, look at some material for yourself, record a short piece about one of the objects that you've seen. If you do this, you'll be given an amazing Stand Up Comedy Archive limited edition t-shirt in your appropriate clothing size.
And a podcast badge as well. And we'll use those recordings in future episodes. And the stupidest way of getting involved is to record your own version of our theme tune, and if we like it, we'll use it in a future episode. One last thing, please leave a review of this podcast on iTunes. It's really important to us. And if you do that, send us a screen grab of your review on an email or something, and leave a postal address and we'll send you a badge.
A History of Comedy and Several Objects is devised and presented by Dr. Oliver Double and Elspeth Miller for the British Stand-Up Comedy Archive, brought to you by the University of Kent. This is made possible by the University of Kent's Public Engagement Research Fund. Photography by Matt Wilson, and editing and production by Matt Hoss.